This is the Rock Voices Oral History Project of Slippery Rock University. Today is Friday, July 31st, 2009, and the time is 1:17 p.m. We're at Bailey Library of Slippery Rock University of Pennsylvania, and this is an oral history interview video with Mr. Mel Klein. The interviewer is Philip Tramdak, Director of Library Services. Good afternoon, Mr. Klein. I'll be asking you some questions about yourself and your time as a student at Slippery Rock. But first of all, let's start with some biographical information. What's your full name and date of birth?
Do I have to say Melvin? Melvin L. Klein.
What did your mother call you? That's the...
Sonny. Mel Klein. Mel. Actually, Melvin L. Klein. And I paid for that in the 50s when the Jerry Lewis movies came out, and his name was Melvin. And my students slyly would say, Melvin.
And what's your date of birth?
March 23rd, 1927.
And where are you
from? By the way, that was the year of Lindbergh, the year of Babe Ruth, and the most important thing was my birth.
The year of Klein.
Right.
Right, okay. And where are you from originally?
I was born in Pittsburgh. Lived in Battle Creek, Michigan for 4 years. I started school. I went to 5 different schools in the first grade. But in the more recent 60 years, came to Slippery Rock after living in Pennsylvania. I graduated from East Pittsburgh High School in 1944. Went to Carnegie Tech for 2 years and then to Slippery Rock after World War II.
And
now we're from New Jersey.
And after you finished at Slippery Rock, the graduate education?
Graduate education. In fact, we were all education majors in those days. It was Slippery Rock State Teachers College. And I got a job teaching in Erie County High School. I taught all the math, all the science, all the boys and girls, phys ed and health, and I coached 4 sports. And we were fed by 6 one-room schoolhouses. Mm-hmm. And McCain, where I was halfway between Erie, PA, and Edinburgh.
What did you want to, as a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Never to grow up. But I didn't know, but in 1944, the war was on, and I had a scholarship to Carnegie Tech, and I played basketball, so I was in engineering, and after about the third semester, I hated it, and my first contact with Slippery Rock was through Carnegie Tech and basketball. I played, it was December of 1944, the first game of the season. Slippery Rock went down to Carnegie Tech, and we played probably the worst college basketball game you could think of, but we beat Slippery Rock 27-25. Then in March, we played up at Slippery Rock, and that was the last game before I went to the service. And eventually, I gave up going to engineering school, and I had taken all my math courses, and I had taught and tutored some sailor shipmates of mine, and they responded to me, and I said, I think this is what I have to be, hence Slippery Rock.
Very good. And you already mentioned about your first job.
Yes. I was there for 2 years, and then went down to Tarentum, PA, which is in Allegheny County, as a math teacher and head basketball and tennis coach.
So your affiliation with Slippery Rock University, you graduated in
1949,
and your degree was?
Bachelor of Science in Education.
Now the school, when you were here, it was called?
Slippery Rock State Teachers College. Mm-hmm. I don't go back to the normal school days.
Not quite to the normal school days, right. Even though you were... did you yourself did not attend a one-room school, did you?
Oh, no.
As a child?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, while you were here, what were some of the campus activities that you engaged in?
I did play basketball. I did write for the school newspaper. I was a sports writer for the school newspaper, and I once figured out how Slippery Rock's football team, by comparative scores, defeated Notre Dame that year. And nobody bought it, but it was fun.
Any other campus activities that you, in retrospect, after 60 years, you can divulge?
Not really. It was, you see, the veterans who came back were pretty much all business, schooling, and that was it. And we played duplicate bridge at the at Dale Houck's house, the president's house. There were about three students and the rest faculty, and Houck used to have bridge about once a month, and had a good time with it. Sometimes we even beat the professors, much to their chagrin.
While we're on the subject, you did talk about going away to the service. Do you want to talk any at all about your experience in the service while you were
sure? As I mentioned, that as a result of my tutoring, some of my shipmates who wanted to get a higher rating or rate, it affected me, and I said, "This is what I want to do." The most important experience was being on an aircraft carrier in 1946. It was just after the war, and I stayed in after the war. And I was involved with the atom bomb testing at Bikini Atoll on July 1st of 1946 and July 30th. Oh, my heavens, this is an anniversary.
It's July 31st.
Of the second bomb. First bomb was dropped from a B-29 and exploded about 10,000 feet above the ocean. And our duty was to send mother planes and robot planes to the mushroom site and send the robot plane through, catch it on the other side, and take it to an island about 150 miles away. The second bomb was floated in the middle of a target area where there were dozens and dozens of old ships. And they floated it in, and it was about, maybe 20 or 30 feet underwater, and then it exploded. And then shortly after that, we sent in, and we really didn't know enough about radiation, but we sent people in with Geiger counters and rubber suits, and just to look at some of the research and some of the testing, because they had animals on board, and we really didn't know anything. And there was a video, a DVD, it was called Radio Bikini, and it was out about 15 years ago, and one of the fellows who was on the search and research committee was in a wheelchair. At the beginning, they showed him here, and then later on, you could see the swollen arms. His legs were cut off, and a year after the DVD, he died of radiation poisoning. Played basketball every night on the carrier, and I played basketball with the answer to a trivia question. The fellow who was the high scorer of the very first NCAA championship was a fellow by my division officer by the name of John Dick, and his picture is in Springfield, the Basketball Hall of Fame. But the most exciting experience and awe-inspiring experience was the two bombs and the devastation that it did create. And it was the same power bomb that did Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Now, we'd like to ask you about some of your, what you consider to be your accomplishments while you were at college. Any accomplishments that you would?
I was the education fraternity, Kappa Delta Pi, did play a little basketball because when I first came, after playing at Carnegie Tech, I had to sit out a year. Then I played the first semester of my senior year, and then the second semester I was doing student teaching. And I have to tell you this, when I look back at it, I brought all my math credits with me, so I didn't really take much math here. But I was able to take courses with folks like Dr. Strain, Principles of Geography, Harold Wiegand, who was U.S. History, Janet Burns, who was a speech teacher, and these people kind of put the humanities touch to my education. Dr. Spotts, English literature, American literature. And it was great for me because I liked to have memorized poetry, and he liked the fact that I did. So
not many people enjoy that.
And I was just thinking of four lines of one of his sonnets, especially when it came to Time to the Atom Bomb. The world is much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers, little we see in nature that is ours. And I thought about that in terms of the atom bomb.
Right.
And still think about it.
Right. It's actually a moving... bit of poetry when you think about the impact on humanity that technology has had in the 20th century.
But that was Dr. Spotts. That was his doing and his class that got me to it. And I often use one of Wordsworth's other poems when I deliver speeches. My heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow in the sky. So was it when my life began. So is it now I am a man. So be it when I shall grow old and die. The child is the father of man. And I use that in different speeches and different occasions. And I go back to Spots on that one. And then I go, in 1965, I spent a July at Williams College on a John Hay Humanities Fellowship. And when I got back to school and as a principal, I developed a whole routine on the humanities with English and social studies. And I go back to the Slippery Rock time with those particular professors, none of whom were my professors for my major. Mm-hmm. And I think between this 1965 thing at Williams and what I had here from those professors, that kind of tied it in for me that the kids in my high school, where I was principal, they're going to be exposed to art, music, literature, and a history teacher and an English teacher were going to plan together so that the literature and the history fit one another. So I think it went back to those folks.
So these professors who, what you're suggesting is there's a good reason why we have buildings named after these people.
Oh, yes. Well, Dr. Swope was music history. I think it was Mrs. Ault, who was an art teacher, professor, and I had music history and art history from those folks. And I remember giving reports in art history on some paintings and things of that sort. Yeah. And 16 years later, no, it was about, yeah, 16 years later, I was able to orchestrate the whole thing for about 700 kids at Glen Ridge High School.
The any of the professors you've mentioned that were noteworthy in your experience, is there one in particular who you identified with or you attached yourself to or who was a mentor in some way?
They weren't necessarily mentors, but I was impressed with the fact that Dr. Strain, who had principles of geography, and we talked about cotton being a one-crop society, then I went into Williams history class, and one of the lines was, well, what caused the Civil War? And Strain had given us the answer to that. And I mentioned Spots, who I really liked his classes in literature. Janet Burns was my speech professor, and I think she kind of took to the kind of speeches that I made, which led to announcing the football games here. And then when WBUT Butler radio station opened up, just about the time we were in school, they wanted somebody to come down there on a Saturday morning and run a show for an hour from Slippery Rock, and there I was. Mm-hmm. So wasn't any just one. They were, I have to put them all in the same group. Again, no math professors, but I brought most of my math major stuff from Carnegie.
That's interesting that your experience here was rich in the humanities and...
Well, the president... now, remember, it was after World War II, before Korean War, and it was it predated U-60s, folks.
Right.
We've had enough of war, and there was the swing for the humanities. And it stayed that way until 1954 when the Russians shot up the Sputnik, and then the gearing all over the place was for math and science.
What did you do you think, how do you think the experience of the at college was affected or influenced by the returning veterans and their perspective?
That's on my list. Veterans coming back were no nonsense people, and I pitied the 17-year-old freshman coming and sitting in the same class as with vets. But I think it had a greater effect on professors, because if a professor said bananas grew on some island, there was somebody in that class who would either say yes or no because I was there. So I think the lectures and the jokes that were on the margins had to change. And I think we had a good effect upon the presentations that professors made after that point. And I think the professors welcomed some of the challenges that they got from the veterans. Mm-hmm. They just didn't let things slide and take for granted. It was a challenging time, I think, for professors. Maybe we should have a little more of that these days.
Possibly. And did you, we talked a moment as you were coming in about the buildings on campus, and the campus at the time that you were here was really confined to what we now call the upper campus, and a few of those buildings are still there. Can you recall anything in particular about the buildings that were here then?
Well, we only had 960 students, so it's probably one-tenth of what we have today.
Yeah, about one-ninth, yeah.
The cafeteria, the food services, was in the first floor of North Hall. And we had the regular breakfast and lunches go online. And see what I do to audiences. But for the evening, we were served family styles. The men and boys had to wear jackets, and there were usually about eight to a table, and there were two sittings, and bell would ring and all of these servers would come out and deposit. There was a piece of meat for every one of the eight, and then there was family style potatoes and vegetables and things. And you met people by being assigned to different tables maybe after 2 or 3 weeks. And you dished out the food for everybody, but that was kind of an interesting thing.
So did the students learn to eat the way you would eat at a mess in Fort Sam Houston, or did the Fort Sam Houston people learn to eat the way you would eat at a college refectory?
I think it was just a way to get the faculty students to know one another. It was small enough that they could do that. And I think it tried to imitate home. Mm-hmm. To something.
Any hijinks at dinner, like throwing bread fights or anything like that?
Nothing like that. Our hijinks were much more sophisticated than
that. Well, you get a chance to tell me about that in a little bit. And your classes, where did you have classes?
There were some in Old Main. I did take a couple of science courses and I have it here. The map.
You had classes in Old
Main? There were classes in Old Main. And
very interesting.
In fact, I think several of my classes were in Old Main.
What floor?
Second, third floor. I don't know. I'm not sure now. But, you know, I'm not sure of that anymore because I'm so out of whack with just visiting here today. The football field was just about the end of the campus.
Right.
And there was a nature trail that went up the road, and a lot of the trees and bushes were labeled. And that was pretty much it.
And the, you said that the chapel was...
We had graduation at the chapel.
Uh-huh. And the... let me think. Where was the library then?
It was called the Maltby Library.
Okay, so the Maltby Library had been built by that time. It was there. Okay. The building we're in now was the successor to the Maltby Library,
right.
Which is the Maltby building is still in use. It's still in use. Where did you live?
First semester on campus, being a transfer student, I lived with a family on Keesler Road. Then the second semester, all the boys and men lived in South Hall, mm-hmm. dormitory living. Mm-hmm. The girls were in North Hall, second, third floors, whatever was mm-hmm. there.
And when you were not studying, how did you, let me go back a step. While you were here, what would you have called home? Where would have been home?
Home would have been East Pittsburgh, PA, and then my family moved, and they told me they were moving, so they didn't try to get rid of me. but my father bought a store, a curtain shop in Erie, PA, so the last 2 years they were in Erie.
So if you were going home from college, I don't imagine you went home every weekend the way students do now.
Didn't go home at all. Mm-hmm. I was in a two-room suite with four other transfers. There were three of them from Pitt, one from Duquesne, and I was from Carnegie Tech. So the one thing we had in common, we were transfer students, and we never went home. Mm-hmm.
Did anybody own a car?
One of my class roommates had a car second year there, but we didn't go anywhere. In fact, when we used to play golf down the road a piece, we used to hitchhike with our golf clubs, mm-hmm. play the one hole from going up, and then paid our fee, and then playing golf. We did most of our evenings were studying. After the dinner, we'd mull around here in North Hall, and the girls would go to their dorms, and we would go where we were, and that was pretty much it. For entertainment, in about 1948 and 49, we walked down the center of town where there was an appliance store, and they had a couple of TVs in the window. And we'd stand outside and watch a little television then.
So there weren't any televisions on campus? In a public room,
No.
You know, like a common room or something like that.
No.
Well, that would have been just at the very beginning of television, and out here they might have had maybe one channel. I don't know, two channels.
Well, they would have had the Pittsburgh channels, the ABC, NBC, and CBS, and that was pretty much, well, the Channel 13
came in, which was... network, maybe, by then.
No, we didn't miss anything because it was no different from home. There was a theater, it was a movie theater. And there was an Isley's ice cream. There was a movie theater right on Main Street. And that too was recreation.
So, if a man wanted to invite a young woman for a date, what would they do?
Maybe go to a movie if the young lady had enough exempt time to go out. The girls were allowed one midnight a month.
That means they were allowed out until midnight?
Yeah.
Once a month. When did they have to get back?
Well, anywhere from 8 to 10 o'clock, 10 10:30.
So did they have like a sign-in sheet or something? They had to sign the book or something like that?
I think they had to sign out and sign in, yes.
Hmm. That's a little different from the way it is today.
Just a little. Just a little.
And so they might go down to the, go into the bill, go into town and go to the movie or go have an ice cream or something like that.
That was it.
Hmm. Interesting. I assure you things are different today.
I have, well, we have three daughters go through school, so yes. I mean, I know that from another point of view.
When you first got here, and especially getting here as you did after serving in the armed forces, can you recall what your first impression of the place was, what your first, what struck you when you were here?
My first impression, other than at the basketball, was playing up here on the campus, and even as an opposing player, the friendliness of the place. Then when I got here, I thought I was going to be an outsider since I was a transfer student. And you got into the hello or howdy tradition. You didn't walk by anybody without saying howdy or hello or getting hello back. Everyone, professors, the president, all the student body. That was one of the things that I remember, and it was just a plain, friendly place. And I compared it to my experiences at Carnegie Tech. I went through a very bad emotional time and a depression time because I knew I hated where I was going with respect to engineering. And I had in the back of my mind this teaching stuff. And Soviet Rock rescued me. I came up here. Dr. Duncan was the dean of students, and he wanted me to start right away. And I told him that I'm going to take off for the summer, but I'll be back here in September. And September of 47, that's when I started. But it just was family. Mm-hmm. And all 960 of us plus faculty were family.
It's small enough student body that you you could know a lot of the people by name and a large part of the class by name, a large part of the college by name.
That was a possibility, yeah.
Did the, you mentioned a little when you were talking about your professors, did the professors invite students to their houses or things like that? Did you have that kind of social interaction?
The social interaction was that bridge, duplicate bridge with the president's house, and there were several faculty members who played there, so we got to know them besides some of our own class professors. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't much invitations to professors' homes.
Coming back from the perspective that you have of now 60 years since you graduated, what do you think is the most, what strikes you most about the campus today? I mean, I can imagine there are buildings, tremendous amount of building, but what are some of the things that impress you about the place or that strike you as surprising?
Just looking at it as a university status with all the different offerings, because in our day it was teaching. Now I wouldn't be surprised if teaching is, or education is one of the smaller schools. I don't know for sure.
It's actually a substantial school here. I'm not sure if it's the largest, but if it's not the largest, it's the second largest. And that's because it's been always been a specialty here.
Mm-hmm. But it's big compared to what I saw. And I don't know whether, in some cases, big is very good. In some cases, you lost some of the familiarity and the friendliness.
Well, I imagine one of the things I look back to from, in comparison to my college experience, which was 40 years ago, is the luxury of many of the, I don't know if you've been in any of the new residences.
No.
You should visit
if you had a chance. We may go on a tour.
You'll be, I invite you to compare with your dormitory room. We're not even allowed to use the word dormitory.
That's what
it's
I understand.
It's a residence, not a dormitory.
Well, South Hall was very old, and but we made do. A lot of us were veterans, and it was a little more luxurious than the sleeping five stacked high in an aircraft carrier.
Right.
And there was a lot of things of that sort. I have to mention one thing. In 1948, September, I volunteered to sit at a desk and check in the new freshmen. And they had the names and their social security number, and they had a letter at the end of the name. H was for Hebrew or Jewish, and being Jewish and not knowing any, I sat in a hound and went through the whole list of young ladies and found two or three H's behind the name, and I ended up marrying one of them.
Very interesting. Using this intelligence to scout a partner. That's intriguing. I wanted to ask you a question. You mentioned the about the greeting the freshmen. Anything about kind of rituals or initiations or any of that kind of
nothing like that.
Activities?
I think what there were no social fraternities. I don't know whether there are now or not. But I think this was the effect of veterans. Didn't want to mess with that nonsense. But everybody was friendly. But no, it was schoolwork, and if we'd go someplace for a bit. We got very good at bringing in laundry boxes. And somehow, bottles of beer got in there. Mm-hmm. But no, the...
There are probably any number of those bottles that are still in a wall somewhere.
That could very well be.
In one of these buildings that somehow got back behind a steam pipe, and it's probably still
could
sitting
still
there.
Could still be.
Wouldn't surprise me, but then, you know.
The socialization was, I think, as a result of the veterans had that in common, and again, I kind of felt sorry for some of the 17-year-old kids coming in who weren't part of that.
Did they have regulations about alcohol in the dorms?
Absolutely. I mean, this was a dry country between here and Grove City. Oh, yes.
So what would have been in the event that, say, a person who had been a veteran of the, war in the Pacific was enjoying beer in his room and he was apprehended, what would have happened to him?
I don't know of that ever happening, and I'm guessing that they would say, you know what it is, don't do it again. Be smart about it. And that would have been the end of it. I just think it was that way.
Mm-hmm. When you say this was dry territory, by that you mean that the jurisdiction, the township was alcohol free, right?
That's correct. There was no bars, none of that.
So I'm not suggesting that you would have ever done such a thing, but someone who had developed a thirst for, say, a bottle of beer, what would they do?
It would have been very rare. Reason is that these were the rules. We were veterans. We're all part of rules.
Yeah, used to.
And that was it.
That's very interesting.
It really wasn't.
In a way, that's hopeful. Actually, that's encouraging.
Again, it goes back to why were we here?
Mm-hmm.
And it was all business in that sense. Yet we all fit into the friendliness of the college.
Do you have any reminiscences or memories of the students that were here at the time you were, and any in particular who were distinguished in some way, or who were movers and shakers, or people who you know, people who come to mind?
Well, I have one sad story, one tragic story. There was a fellow, Paul Clausen, who had been a captain in the during World War II. He was a junior. He was a year behind me, and we played on the same softball team and things of that sort. And I had just graduated in 49, and in 1950, the Korean War started. And Paul was called. And I remember they told me this, that he had a conversation with Marie McKay, who was the registrar. And Marie said to him, we'll have a place for you. Never came back. He was killed dragging one of his platoon to safety. And he was such a friendly, good guy. He was missed. He was missed. And there may be something in the school that, in a memorial for him, but I'm not sure about
that. The name is familiar, Clausen. I've heard that name. It wouldn't surprise me if there was a memorial somewhere.
And we had about four or five men who were elementary majors. They graduated from Slippery Rock, got a job teaching sixth grade in an elementary school. 15 minutes later, they became principals. And 15 minutes after that, they were superintendents. They were probably, in my class, they were probably all got to the superintendency a lot faster than the rest of us. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a career math teacher, and I did that for 15 years. And then became a high school principal and wanted to be that as a career. But things happened and changed, and I ended up as a superintendent of schools. And I relate one thing with respect to that. During the Depression, I went to five different schools in first grade between Ohio and Pennsylvania. Depression, father working, looking for work. In 1983, I started, after I so-called retired as a superintendent, I sold insurance very badly for a year. And some district called up and asked if I would be an interim soup. So I spent the next 15 years doing 19 interim soups all over the state of New Jersey. So I go back to the first grade, and then I relate it to my career as a... In fact, I hold the record in New Jersey, although there is somebody who's probably going to break that record, but they always remember Babe Ruth first anyhow. And I think one other thing that as a result of... I was kind of a pioneer in cable television. The town where I worked as a superintendent, Livingston, was the second community to be wired for cable. And there was very little local programming. So I had a program called the Superintendent's Forum, and I had it for 4 years. And it was very local. It wasn't what it is today. And I would tape a show once a month, and they played it on our local channel twice a week, and then each month I'd have a new show. And that was really the beginning of everything for cable television.
What do you recall when that would have been, approximately what year?
Yeah, it would have been 77 to 81. Mm-hmm. Livingston was wired up in 1977. And then I started programs right then. Mm-hmm. I had the Commissioner of Education. I had one group. I brought back three students who had just finished their freshman year in college, and the idea was, if you had it to do over again, what would you do anything differently? Well, one of the three was an actor, and he stayed in acting, and he plays the part of George on Seinfeld. He graduated from Livingston High School. Jason Alexander, for this example. So, yeah, we had a good time with it. And again, I'm amazed when we say there's about, close to 10,000 students.
I think there are about 8,500 students here, full-time equivalent.
I did spend some time. After I graduated, I was up there in Erie, and I scouted Gannon College for a football game for Slippery Rock. So I'd come down because I'd come down to see my about-to-be wife, who was at that time was a sophomore here. So I'd come back and forth and do what I could as far as that was concerned. And in 1948, we, for homecoming, we had the Rocket Man. And I think there's a picture of him in our in this yearbook. A fellow by the name of Jim Jewell became the Rocket Man. And we introduced him at the night before the homecoming football game. I don't know whether they kept that tradition or not.
So was the mascot a rocket?
The Rocket Man.
Now, I don't know. I'm not sure what the mascot is now. It may be a lion, I think, a lion. And then I'm wondering if they ever had a rock as a mascot. Probably not.
No, the closest, well, at least in my time, the closest was Rocket Man. He was a gymnast, so he combined a lot of stuff. And this was before my time. It was about 1938. And I think it was the one item that got Slippery Rock nationwide attention. It was a sports writer by the name of Cunningham, writing for a Boston newspaper, and it was during the football season, I think in 38 or so, and as a gag, he was supposed to pick 20 teams to win, and as a gag, he picked Slippery Rock to win. Now, he's waiting all Saturday night, and finally the Slippery Rock score came in, and Slippery Rock won, and he won the pool, and then on Monday, I think he wrote a poem, Slippery Rock, that great school helped me win the football pool, and it made it in the Boston papers. And then, and one time, Slippery Rock did go to the Sun Bowl. It was in the 30s. So, between that and the athletic director at the University of Michigan also put us on the map even more. They used to have band day at the University of Michigan, and the high school bands came in, they took up too many seats. So he decided to have band day on a day when the football team was playing away. And he invited Slippery Rock and the team that they were to have played on that Saturday to come up to Michigan and play. And they played before a crowd, and they'd have band day. And they played before a crowd that was probably bigger than any, the whole season than any of those two schools had. So. And I understand that Michigan and the state of Texas would flood the bookstore for mail orders of Slippery Rock paraphernalia.
Those are two interesting anecdotes. I think we'll try and track down that poem if we can. We must have some record of it somewhere. And the other is the thing I found out about when I got here in 2002, I grew up in Pennsylvania. So I always knew of Slippery Rock. It was a place that people used to go to college from where I grew up outside of Philadelphia. You came to Slippery Rock either to be a gym teacher or because it was as far as you could get from mom and dad and still be in the state of Pennsylvania. That was the other reason. But Slippery Rock is always... I found out now it's a real recognizable brand. People all over the place have heard of Slippery Rock.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something distinguished that I never realized until I got here. You were talking about Rocket Man there, I've never heard of him before. But do you remember anything else about any other events that took place while you were here that you can recall? Of any kind, whether it be political events, campus events, weather events, just plain interesting things.
The night before, I believe it's the opening game of the football season, we played Westminster on our field. The night before, a group of Westminster College folks came over. And they were going to ring the bell because the tradition was every time Slippery Rock won a game, the first people back from the game, if it was home or away, would talk to Charlie, who was the security person He was the whole security staff. And we would say, "We won, Charlie, ring the bell." The Westminster guys came over and they were going to ring the bell. We got word of it and we put up the defenses and we captured several of them. And on the day of the game, we paraded them. We got some of the young ladies to give us clothes and we clothed them in women's clothes and paraded them. In fact, there's a picture in the yearbook of that particular scene. And that worked out pretty well. It was fun. And we treated them nicely and they behaved. So and
did they invite you over to Westminster to return the favor?
I think they were on the alert. I don't know whether anybody afterward from here decided they were going to try to go one-upsmanship on the Westminster crowd. But they were a rival in Grove City. In fact, the same year we played at Grove City, we won, and for whatever reason, we tore the goalposts down. I don't know why, but we did. Well,
people used to do stuff like that. I can even remember.
Hang on for a tiny second. I'm just looking at this.
This
thing is not recording anymore.
Did you run out of tape?
That's not possible.
No.
We're still recording on the tape recorder. Let me just see what could possibly have
gone on here. There's power.
And I mean, we're still recording, so we have a very it doesn't seem to be getting power to the thing.
Why? I don't know. I haven't touched anything. You didn't jump up and grab the wire.
I certainly wouldn't do that. I'm too much of a ham to.
Oh, look at that. The I just noticed this a second ago. All right, here's what happened. The wire wasn't in, the battery went out, but now it's on again. Mm-hmm. So we might have dropped about 5 minutes or 3 minutes of the video, but that's okay, because I've been keeping my eye on it to see if it's everything is lined up. So we're back with the video now, after a slight interregnum, we're still continuing.
It was time out for a commercial break.
Yeah, it was time out for a commercial break. The question that was that we were talking about events that happened here, and you were talking about capturing the students from Westminster. I was wondering if you had any other reminiscences of. Any particular event that would have taken place, for instance, while you were here, would have been the 1948 presidential election. There were political events. Anything you might remember about the weather or anything that spectacular that might have happened?
Nothing spectacular in that sense. We did have some guest speakers. I remember there was a variety of guest speakers that were held in the chapel, and Eli Culberson's wife, who was a bridge expert, was a devotee of United Nations and things of that sort. But we were pretty much a fairly closed community, and we were with ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we made the events, the local events. Mm-hmm. And one thing that happened while we were here, we were the Middle States Visitation Committee came in. It was kind of fun because years later I went to 9 Middle States High School and I chaired 3 of the 9. And then I also was on a Middle States at visited 2 universities. So the experience from that.
We're doing a Middle States review right now, this year.
Yeah.
Where many of us are involved in that. One thing, a characteristic of Western Pennsylvania is the weather, which I don't imagine the weather then was much worse than it is now in the winter. A cold winter now is probably comparable to a cold winter then.
Yes.
But the I imagine that the resources for snow removal were not as available then as they maybe are now. Did you ever get the feeling that you were kind of getting closed in, or
no,
you were?
I'll tell you what it was, though. My first teaching position in McCain, up in Erie County, that would have been the 1949. And the Thanksgiving, the day after Thanksgiving in 1950, it snowed 36 inches worth. That's the biggest snowstorm that I felt at that time, probably ever. But I don't recall having any problems at all at Slippery Rock during the 2 years that I was there. Yeah, it was pretty good.
People were pretty resourceful. Nowadays, they come out with the plows, but of course, the principal concern is getting the parking lots clear so people can drive their cars. If people don't have a lot of cars, then
that's
you don't worry about it.
That going back to that particular thing, as a superintendent of schools, one of the toughest jobs was, should I call off school? Should I have a delayed opening? Or should we have school? And I don't even think the Harvard School of Education prepares people for those kind of decisions.
I'll tell you, here it's just as difficult a decision because although the university obviously never closes because we have 3,000 people who live here, and we have to provide services. The library, for instance, is open. We're always open. We never close because of the weather. Somebody can get here. Somebody who lives in town can get here. But the issue of when to cancel classes is always a touchy issue.
There was one thing I wanted to ask you in terms of relationship with the community, like the library.
Right.
The people in the community have access to this library?
Yeah, well, recently in the last 6 years, we provide anybody with a 16057 zip code with a library card if they want one.
Oh.
We also give any school teacher from a Slippery Rock Township or surrounding townships, districts, a free library card and access to the materials here. And I was going to ask you about relations with the community and with the town. If you could talk a little bit about how, whether you all had a lot of contact with people in town. I'm sure you have the storekeepers and the townsfolk who worked in the Main Street and the various shops, but were there other points of contact?
Well, as you mentioned, as a matter of fact, I had a cousin who owned a store, who owned a department store right on Main Street, and so I was friendly with them. But I think we acted as citizens of the community and spent most of our time here. But I don't think there's anything that was unusual.
Just wondering if there, on top of everything that you've mentioned here, if there are any other memories that you have, or memories of a personal nature that you would like to talk about more at length regarding your years at Slippery Rock.
Well, I might have mentioned I did start the Saturday rowing program at WBUT Butler. Got down there. I don't remember how I even got down there. I think I might have borrowed a car from roommate, and did a Saturday morning show. We did recordings, we did news briefs, and at various times I had talented people from the college come down and perform in the radio studio. And that was a first. And I enjoyed that, and it started me thinking about that kind of a career. In fact, after I retired as a superintendent the first time, I did it as a result of going into TV production, which I did. And I think I mentioned that I had a TV show for local programming. But in addition to that, as a result of all of these experiences I had here, I helped produce several videos, anything from how to raise money for college tuition, how to pick colleges, anything. It was for parents and teachers and faculty. How to conduct a parent conference, things of that sort. So you know, I can go back to Slippery Rock for that kind of background. And when we had the 1949 had that our gala spoof show at the end of the time, I emceed that, and there were stuff written by some talented people, and I kind of orchestrated it. And I've done all of that kind of thing.
Just wondering if you have any other things that you had noted in your preparation for coming to speak with us today that you wanted to bring up.
Let me look down. I think I did very well.
I think so.
In terms of, I have to tell you one story. Coach Thompson, after whom the field was named after. Coach Thompson was a basketball and football coach at Slippery Rock prior to my time. But he was a seventh grade math teacher at the lab school. And he was, the student teaching, I had a class of seventh graders, I had a physics class, and I had a high school math class. And I remember once with the seventh graders, I asked one of the kids if one of those old things, if two pencils cost 10 cents, how much would four pencils cost? And the little boy, he floundered around with it. I'm not sure that that was the example, but that was that kind of thing. And after the class was over, Coach Thompson, he said, "Mel, now little Cooper, every morning, gets up, gathers the eggs, and goes sells the eggs to the neighbors. He says, the next time you do one with Cooper, instead of asking him about pencils, ask him about eggs." And it was sometimes a practical example hits the nerve, but that was one of Coach Thompson's gems. Good guy. And I started the second day of teaching at the 12th grade math, and I made mention of being at Bikini for the atom bomb test. And my coordinating teacher went and looked up that I had this, and then the next day he asked me to do the assignment, the homework assignments with the kids. He walked out of class and he came back about 6 weeks later, so I ran the whole thing. And I became maybe too independent because I went right into being a high school basketball coach. I was never anybody's assistant. And when it came time to deal with somebody who, like as a principal and a superintendent, who had different philosophies from me, we did bang heads a little bit.
It was a learning experience.
Well, I consider that a learning experience for that superintendent at that time. See, vanity hasn't left me.
Any other things you would like to remind our community or?
Well, I was very happy to do this. It helped me reflect because I'm hopeful to do something else. And it's something that caught my ear from one of Bill Clinton's comments about everybody should write their biography, if for no other reason than for their family. And we have three daughters, and one of them especially wanted to know more about what I do and what I did. And I think what we're going to do is set up something like that and start right from the beginning for grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I'm a great believer in collecting and saving and the history of family. And I think and this helps me get through with it. And I hope maybe if I get a chance, I can get a copy of this too.
Well, we will provide you with the, first we provide you with the transcript and then to review. And then we'll, this is supposed to be mounted on a website so people can see it. And then the audio portion will also be made available. I mean, the key here is the audio, which is the, we have a continuous recording, and I'm not at all clear on what's going on with this piece of, which is sort of, to me, was the backup, having the film or the camera. If there isn't anything else that you wanted to add, then I guess we've concluded, and I want to thank you very much.
My pleasure, and thank you, because again, I think it will inspire me more to get going on this family thing.
All right, I'm going to turn this off now. We've gone just over an hour.